Welcome everyone to this week's edition of the Commercial Real Estate 101 Meetup Group. For those of you guys who are tuning in for the first time, we actually host these events every other week and we invite speakers to talk about a variety of different topics pertaining to commercial real estate. And I'm really excited today to invite Henry on. I've actually been watching his videos for a little while now. He's been really making a big splash on the YouTube scene, and I had the honor and privilege of being on his podcast recently, and I thought it'd be a great opportunity for us to kind of learn from someone who's really making a big impact in the commercial real estate space. So I'm looking forward to having this discussion. Henry, welcome.
Thank you for having me on, my friend. Looking forward to this.
Oh, absolutely, man. So what we typically like to do when we first get started is we like to learn a little bit more about the person that's across the table from us. So if you don't mind kind of sharing a little bit about your backstory, I think that'd be awesome.
Sure. I was the quiet kid in the back of the room for a long time growing up. Really had no idea what I wanted to do. And my father was a school teacher, and my mom worked as like a back office manager for AIG. So I didn't come from like an entrepreneurial household per se. But the one thing I knew is that I did not want what my parents had. I love them dearly, but I definitely did not want the life that they had. So I was like, you know what, I'm gonna do anything possible that is not on that map. So I ended up getting into the real estate world when I was 20 years old. I was lied to about how much somebody was making in the real estate world, so I decided to get my license and file suit. First couple of years were terrible, but over the last just shy of 9 years, I've been a part of over $500 million worth of real estate transactions. I have a decent sized commercial sales team based out of New Jersey. Been a part of over 100 flips, dozens of wholesale deals. I own a number of commercial properties myself, and now I coach people on how to do the same.
That's amazing, man. It really is. And like you had mentioned, I mean, early on, you know, I guess one of the questions I had is why real estate? You had mentioned that your parents, somewhat to mine. Like in my background, my dad was in pediatrician, so he always wanted me to be a doctor. He always wanted me to kind of follow the higher education route, and for me, it just really never was something that I was very interested in. I studied engineering, but I knew long-term I didn't want to be a design engineer and all this other stuff. So, you know, I always had that entrepreneurial itch, and I could see it in your interactions and in your eyes. Like, that's just something that you innately had for a long period of time, but kind of curious as to why you chose the real estate route when you first got started.
Yeah. So, more than anything, I just knew at a younger age, because I had been exposed to in my late teens, people who work for themselves, right? So people mm-hmm. who are self-employed. And I saw the freedoms that allowed for these individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Had some decent mentors in my late teens that opened up my eyes to that. Real estate, honestly, was not what I wanted to do. Again, I got into it because a friend lied to me about how much money he was making on a monthly basis. And I was like, I knew for a fact that I could outwork that person. I was like, if this was a young kid, 21 or so years old, said to me he was making $20,000 a month every month. And I was like, I was making 70 a year at 20. And I was like, 20 a month, that's freaking mind blowing. I'm like, I work twice as hard, five times as hard as you do. Like, I know I could do it. I lost everything in my first 12 to 24 months in real estate. So it definitely didn't go well, but that's sort of what led to me. And plus, like, my grandparents actually, one thing that I'm very close to my grandparents. I love that. I still have all four of my grandparents around. I really enjoy spending time with them. I know how lucky I am with that. Yeah. And one set bought a lot of real estate. They had bought a lot of real estate. They were big time investors, but no one's a broker per se. But that it also just kind of gave me the bug of, owning investment properties one day and seeing what they would like.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I know on your podcast, we had talked a little bit about, like, our grandparents being big inspirations in our lives and just the work ethic of that generation. It's great. So I appreciate you sharing that context when it came to that. But so one of the things that, obviously with each discussion that we have on the Commercial Real Estate 101 podcast, we try to focus on a particular topic. So in today's topic, we focused on off-market deals, which is something that I know you're an expert in. You've obviously been kind of been your MO the last, however long that you've been operating in that space. So kind of curious about, how did you start in the process of kind of sourcing opportunities for your buyers, when, let's say, a couple of years in? Because I know initially you had mentioned how you had some struggles early on, but if you could kind of share that transition point where you started focusing a lot more on sourcing these types of opportunities and how you were able to do that.
Sure. So I initially got into it because in the resi world, where I had built up to over 100 transactions a year, I was very investor heavy. So I learned the game of the wholesaling world, the flipping world, from being in the residential business. And then my investors graduated into bigger deals. So I graduated slowly into bigger deals. And eventually, when I now, you know, and even for the last few years, now essentially 99% of what I do is commercial. It just seems so normal to me that every investment deal essentially is off market. Like, I'm not here to list, like, if think about it, like, you know, in my mind is always like, if you find a really good off market investment deal, you're either buying it yourself or you're immediately selling it to somebody else. Why on planet Earth am I listing it on the market? Right. Like, I never, that was never something that was even part of the process for me, essentially. So I've just continued that process for the most part. And, you know, personally, I've always thought, and from, you know, you talk to a lot of investors, obviously, just like I do, it's like most of the deals you see on the market are not spectacular, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of those, it's like the, you know, the junk cars, right, per se, that they can't sell in other ways. Like, it's like, if they were good deals, that broker would not be listing it on the market because they have a pool of investors and they would just sell it real quick, right? That's why a large majority of great off market, you know, you ever see the, like, oh my God, that sold? How did I not know about it? It's because a commercial broker did the deal off market. So it's like that, that's, you know, a lot of just been my history has just been really all off market investment deals. So I just can kind of continue that.
That's awesome. Yeah, I know. And so as far as the process itself is concerned, we kind of talked a little bit offline about, you know, you're obviously relocated now to Florida. But your processes are still the same. I mean, you're operating on a daily basis and approaching the business development process with a rigorous approach. So if you could kind of share some insights pertaining to how you approach that process so that you can generate opportunities for your clients, I think that'd be great.
Sure. So, and actually, I just put out a couple of videos about this specifically, mm-hmm. talking about this process. And I break it down to a few key things. Number one is the lists that you're pulling, because the very clean, simple statement I always talk about is you sell what you prospect for, right? So if you are prospecting for X type of asset class, right? If you pull a list of 10,000 to 50,000 square foot industrial properties and you start prospecting that list, that's probably what you're going to sell. So right? I mean, I know this sounds incredibly obvious, but people are just like, how do I sell different things? It depends on what list you're pulling and who you're prospecting, because you're probably going to end up selling that, right? So we get really clear on what our investors are looking for. And we just pull lists from Reonomy and CoStar, where we all can pull data from. I throw it through a skip tracing software where I can pull the most accurate information possible. So we're not just wasting our time calling a bunch of different random phone numbers that are not accurate. And then, you know, so the list is where it starts. Then we throw that list that has been skip traced into a dialer, you know, and actually, you know I moved down to Miami. I actually just came up for the a couple of days to be with my sales team. So they're all making a bunch of sales calls outside. You know, so, you know, I can hear them freaking pounding the phones out there, but I love the energy, but we pound phones like crazy. I mean, our team is doing, you know, between, you know, 1500 to 3000 dials a day, to those types of properties that they're, you know, that our clients are looking for. So this affords us the ability of finding several halfway decent opportunities, you know, pretty regularly, you know. But the biggest thing that I stress in my content that I think differentiates us from the majority is that we think like investors first. So what I do differently is that instead of pitching for a listing and trying to list a property for sale, we underwrite the deals ourselves and make an offer right off the bat. We make an offer 100% of the time on every lead that we generate. Because what this shows is that we try to condense the time frame in that sales cycle. So, you know, we get a person on the phone who's got a strip center, industrial building, multifamily, whatever it is, we underwrite it right away. We try to get all the financials and all the details we possibly can, and whatever they're willing to share with us, we make an offer. We get some feedback right away. And this way, I already know where they're going to be at price-wise, because we treat our buyer as the client. And our sellers, and we try to get those deals locked up so we can deliver them on a silver platter ahead of time.
That's amazing. No, and that's super smart. So you're taking, so just so I can summarize it so everyone understands what's going on. So from the business development standpoint, you compile a list from, you know, there's a bunch of sources you can compile a list from, but you had mentioned one being Reonomy, obviously CoStar, kind of the behemoths when it comes to, you know, compiling of data in the commercial real estate space. Skip tracing, for those of you guys who don't know, is a service where they would scour the internet and try to get the most accurate contact information for individuals. So once you kind of pass it through the script tracing service. And then most of the time you pay a fee for it, but it's well worth the fee because you don't want to waste your time calling a bunch of different numbers that aren't going to be real. So exactly. Obviously it's worth the call. And then from there, you take a very deliberate process about hitting your dials on a day-to-day basis. And related to the underwriting process, this is something that you've talked to your clients about already. You know exactly what they're looking for. And you probably have criteria that you already are going to be kind of cross-referencing as you're underwriting these deals. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're probably not underwriting the deals immediately. You're probably finishing your dials. And then at the end of the day, like on the weekends or you know, after the call time, then you go through that process. Cause that's right. Something that, you know, I obviously you interrupt the dial time. It's going to obviously throw off your cycle or throw off your rhythm, I imagine.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, like you had alluded to, you know, I moved to Miami, right? So like, mm-hmm. I'm not with my sales team all day long. Mm-hmm. And like, we have structured meetings later in the day to specifically talk about specific topics. So like, we have our dial sessions in the morning. So each of our sales members is required to make 4 hours of dials every day. So that's somewhere that comes to about 300 to 400 minimum or so dials a day. And all those leads then get put into a system where I get an exact breakdown of all of the deals from the day. And then I basically take the entire next day to basically reach out to those people specifically personally to have the further conversation, to try to structure creative deals, to try to work through an offer, to try to get the best deal possible structured so that I can bring it to the investors, right? So my salespeople don't really even take any of those steps. They're just specifically lining up opportunities for me to take it to the next step.
That's awesome. Yeah. And you've built out those processes over time, obviously. So one thing I'm kind of curious about, you know, obviously, let's say, you know, you get someone on the phone, they're interested in discussing the possibility of selling, because obviously, you know, it's very rare you get a phone call and you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's very rare that I've had an interactions where it's like, oh yeah, let's go ahead and make this work. A lot of times it's a lot of massaging, a lot of working through a lot of things to finally get to where they're at as far as their pricing is concerned. So, you know, when it comes to how you approach the process with a seller, once you have them on the phone and they've shown even a little bit of interest in potentially selling, what are some of the things that you're kind of working through to try to just extract as much data as you possibly can?
Yeah. So what's important to note is that essentially the second you get information from somebody, okay, I get your cell phone number, right? Mm-hmm. We need to realize that less than 2% of all transactions are handled in the very first sale. Less than 2%. I think it's probably closer to 0.5% of all transactions happen because of your very first phone call, where AKA you call somebody up, like you said, and they're like, yeah, I'm looking to sell, right? Less than 0.5%. So the vast majority of all transactions that take place are because someone had a second, third, fifth, eighth, 20th conversation with somebody down the road over a period of time, right? Build a relationship. You start getting some more information on the deal. There's a trust factor that's created, and then you can slowly end up having a transaction, right? You know, a lot of what we're closing on right now are conversations that we've been having with people for the last 12, 24, 36 months, right? That's why building a pipeline is so drastically important, because especially because even if you got a deal under contract today, you're probably taking 90 days to close this sucker at the absolute fastest, right? Mm-hmm. So it's you know, it's about keeping a pipeline full at all times, so you have, you know, you're convert. It's like the second piece of all this is that it's the conversion game, right? It's all about conversion now. And so, you know, I spoke to somebody today who said that they're open to possibly selling a 5-acre parcel in a very, very popular area near me, or near where I used to live in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Now the next step here is like, listen, they're like, oh yeah, I've been offered $5 million a bunch of times. I declined it. We actually want somewhere closer to 7 million. There's a lot more next steps here, which is, can I get them to agree to a creative seller financing offer? Can I get them to agree to certain terms up front, which make it more lucrative to an investor to possibly make sense of doing this deal? And also just realizing, if there's no motivation, right? Investors need to make money. So if there's no motivation for a seller, like zero, next to nothing, just the, hey, make me an offer kind of thing, and they have absolutely no interest in selling, which is why we make offers right away. So I vet that motivation level. How high are they on that motivation scale? If it's next to zero and they have no interest in it, it's a crazy high price, that's a 6-month, 12-month, 24 drip campaign type of lead. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. right? So, but I just want to know, so I don't spend every waking moment trying to hound this person thinking that this is going to be a great deal. So I play the conversion game, which is why we try to figure out the motivation level. So that's why we make offers. That's why we slowly try to chip away at different types of creative financing structures that allow us to try to eventually get to the place where there's an agreeable deal here for both parties.
That's amazing. No, that's a great point. And like you said, understanding the motivation level early on saves you time. And that doesn't mean that it's the deal per se is not going to work today, but it may work in 24 months. So always keeping that touch point over a period of time is a brilliant move, man, really. And that, and most people don't do that. So I commend you for that. So as far as the way that you've been able to structure deals, in particular in this environment, obviously, as we're recording this and we're live streaming right now, it is September of 2023, I should say. Interest rates have been, in flux for the last, about a year now, and we're probably hovering in that 7-8% range if you're talking about conventional financing. So you kind of alluded to a few tactics that have, I'm sure, served you well in this environment. Could you kind of elaborate on a few? Obviously, one being seller financing, the other, what other types of terms are you trying to structure so that, even if, let's say, the pricing is a little bit outside of what you would typically want as far as the purchase is concerned, but if they're able to, make it work in some other way, then obviously we can make it work.
Yeah. So again, to continue to kind of keep nailing this point home is, as interest rates rise, as the economy keeps being in turbulence or more and more turbulence, right, making things a little bit more complex, deals have to be better, right? You have to continuously structure better and better deals. We got really freaking, I don't know what the word is here. We got so used to, these low rates where you could get a 4.5 cap deal and be cash flowing at a crazy percentage where it's just not normal. So even beforehand, when rates were 4.5, 5, right, and you'd get a 5 cap or a 6 cap, you still had to structure some type of way where it was a creative structuring in the deal where it has to make sense. Again, if the property doesn't make dollars, if there's no way for an investor to make money, they're not going to buy the deal. And by the way, if you were in their shoes, you wouldn't buy it either, especially where today you can put your money in the bank account, in a simple bank account, and make 5% a year on your money. So why would you buy a deal where you're going to make less than 5% on their money? Like, I was just structuring a deal. I'll explain this one. We're working on a retail deal. The seller wants just under $11 million for a retail property. Property brings in $750,000 in net operating income. So it's about a 7 cap in regards to what they're asking. The cash on cash return based on today's financing, this was yesterday's conversation with our mortgage lender, still with competitive rates and the whole nine yards, right? No crazy points and all that stuff, right? It's a 4% cash on cash on a 7 cap deal, which everyone thinks is such a great thing right now, right? Or it used to be such a great thing. So it's like, how do you make that make sense? Well, the only way that you can make sense of that, think about how this works. You either have to lower the cost of debt. Okay, you have to lower the cost of debt, or you have to increase the income of the property. There's only two ways to play this. And 9 times out of 10, you're probably not going to be able to increase the income of a property day one or prior to buying it, right? So most of it has to do with, how do you lower the cost of holding this asset so that I have more money to play with, more cash flow, which is again, the difference between how much money the property is bringing in and the cost of holding this asset. So how do you work that? A lot of what we're dealing with right now is the sellers, we're negotiating sellers holding back notes at very low interest rates, a smaller percentage. So like, hey, if I got you an offer for $11 million, would you be able to, would you be open to possibly taking payments over time? Use that script, by the way, which is we found great success with, which is saying, would you be open to taking payments over time? I think is a better way to say seller financing. And so we found some success there. But it's saying like, hey, we'll get you the 11 million. Matter of fact, we're going to put down 90%. Would you hold $1 million? Right. And would you hold it at 4%, 3% interest only? We're allowing the less money out of pocket for this, for the investor, which means that you'll have now skewed returns on the amount of money that you're generating now. So you try to limit the amount of money that the investor has to come out of pocket, and try to work with the seller to have them hold back some level of paper in some way, shape, and form. And you can also try to negotiate prior to closing. Hey, can we, you know, this is the income side of it. Hey, would you be totally against us working on leasing out the vacant spaces prior to closing? Where like now I can get the income on this property from $750 to $850 locked in guaranteed. And now it's like, okay, well, and you also get them to hold back $1 million in paper at 4% interest only with those built things. Now, all of a sudden that cash on cash isn't 4%. Now it's 6.5 or 7. And you only like these are two small things you just have to work on through the deal. So it's finding those abilities where other realtors are not thinking about finding value.
Yeah. And that goes back to the exact point you mentioned, thinking like an investor, really understanding what the motivation of someone is. Because at the end of the day, if the numbers don't make sense, like you said, if I have several $1 million and I'm going to buy this strip center and it's only giving me a 3 or 4% cash on cash return, why would you go through the hassle, through the headache of having to deal with whatever comes along with ownership of these types of assets, if I can literally go to a bank, put my money in that bank account and get 3, 4, or 5%, whatever the offering is for the at the time. So that's some great insight that you shared there. So I just wanted to reiterate that. So one of the things that I'm kind of interested in is as you started to scale, I think one of the hardest parts too is, you know, let's say you're in it for a couple of years, you're starting to generate your business. And I feel like that's kind of where, just candidly, that's where kind of where I'm at, where I'm starting to get a lot more opportunities and you're working to try to scale your operations to a point where now, even though the opportunities are coming with you, you can service those types of opportunities. I guess when you're at that stage in your evolution, what exactly were you doing as far as systematizing things? Like, I'm all about systems. I come from a, you know, background in operations. And so, you know, I'm always interested in seeing what other people are doing as far as like optimizing things so that they can actually grow their enterprise over time.
Yeah. So, I heard from a very successful friend of mine recently, it was like maybe 2 years ago, that really shifted my mindset with a lot of things, which is, because my philosophy was like, okay, well, I'm a commercial broker, you know, I'm starting to make some decent money. If I come across great investment deals, I'm going to be buying these deals. Then all of a sudden you start buying a bunch of properties. You know, I own a bunch of these properties and now I have to manage them. And I'm like, wait a second, now I have another job and I don't want to do that. I want to just focus on what was actually making me money in the first place. When this, like, all of a sudden I'm doing all these extra tasks that have nothing to do with what will actually get me to my next goal, right? So what I realized was that you have to give up some aspect of the game in order to excel in another, right? So it's like, I want to own a lot of real estate, but I never needed, like my goal is to own a lot of real estate, but why, right? Like, well, I want passive income. Okay. And I also want to build my net worth over time. Okay. Well, I could partner with a fantastic operator who's way smarter than me, more seasoned than me, who owns a lot of real estate. And I could just move my money into that deal with them, find a partner to buy the deal with who does all the work for me. And I could be a small percentage owner in that deal and just collect a check. I still accomplished owning real estate. I still accomplished earning passive income, but I have no effort being exerted, no time being taken. And I try to take that mindset from everything that I look at now, which is like, even with scaling the team, I don't want to add more to my plate. I want to grow the business, but I don't want to put more things on my plate. So I have to find an individual to handle X tasks that have to be done so that I could, like, the company can grow, the goal can still grow, but I don't need to make 100% and I'm also not exerting as much effort into that, right? So like, I'm looking at like more the expense of not just the cost of money, but the cost of my time. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's even like where now I'm in Miami and I have a team that runs in New Jersey, but it's because I have great people in place to do so. I think that having the right support, the right assistance, the right mindset for each task, I think will allow you to scale without massive effort per se.
Yeah. And I think what one of the profound points that you just made, which I like to extract a little bit, is that mindset shift where it's like, you know, I can't tell you, you know, how many times in the past I've been like, well, you know, I could do this and save on this. But in reality, it's like, what is your time really worth? Like, if you're doing a task that you could potentially pay someone, you know, $20 an hour, $30 an hour, $50 an hour to do, and you can dedicate your time towards something else that's generating 10x that, why in the world would you not try to outsource that or try to, you know, expand, you know, your team to support a function that is not going to be your highest and best use? So. 100%.
And it's, yeah. I mean, like, I, again, like for me, it's always like, if you own a restaurant, are you also the dishwasher? Are you, like, Why you're not for a specific reason. Well, I could just delegate that. Well, in most real estate businesses, you commonly see that the owner of the real estate business, the realtor, right, is the dishwasher, the waitress, the chef, the hostess, the everything. And it's like, why do you think like that? Right? Like positions also, like I have some VAs I pay $4 an hour for that handle certain tasks that are $4 an hour tasks.
Yeah.
Right? But I'm not going to delegate my prospecting because that's $1,000+ an hour active, you know, activity. So I'm going to prospect.
100%. Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more, man. And I appreciate the insight there because I feel like there's so many people out there that kind of fall into that. And even people who are performing at a high level. I mean, they may be generating a lot of income, but they're burning the candles at both ends because they're trying to do everything themselves. When in reality, even if they were to take a little bit less, and in theory, you know, you maybe take a step back as far as income's concerned, that you'd keep yourself, but you can take 2, 3, 4, 5x steps in a year or two. And, I mean, that's.
And yeah, like, I actually literally just posted a video about like how, like my goal is to be a billionaire. And I talked about in the video of my plan to do so. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like a lot of that is saying like, hey, if I just take a few deals every year, one a quarter or maybe two a year, not anything crazy, but just the best stuff per year that I sell to a couple different investors who I have very good relationships with, who are great operators, like I'm saying, and I just wrap my commission into the deal. Instead of taking a $100,000 check or whatever it is, I wrap it into the deal. And now I have no commission on that deal, but now I'm a percentage owner in that property. And now that 100 grand, as an example, will return me 7 or 8-ish% a year on that money over a 10-year period of time. All of a sudden, my cash flow might exceed your active income, right? And I'm not doing any extra work. There's no additional work there. And I'm accomplishing all those extra things. It's like I was speaking to a realtor and he's like, oh yeah, I just invested in this franchise. I'm like, so how much prospecting? He goes, oh, I haven't done any prospecting because I've been so busy with this franchise that I invested in. I'm like, why did you get a second job? Because he was making a killing in real estate, but you got to sit. Now you just bought yourself a second job. Why would you do that? I don't buy myself. Like that doesn't make it an investment anymore. Right.
That's awesome.
I don't want a second job.
No, I agree. And that's some great insight. So, you know, what I'll go ahead and do is I have one final question. And then what we'll like to do is open up to Q&A because we got a good amount of people on the call and, you know, we're also live on LinkedIn. So we want to give people an opportunity to kind of ask questions that they have. Awesome. But as far as, you know, let's say that, you know, obviously we're in an environment where the transaction volume is obviously diminished a little bit. So I know there's a lot of people out there that are just trying to find ways to really kind of maximize whatever they're able to do on a day-to-day basis. What type of advice would you give to someone, kind of a short and sweet advice to say, look, how can you go from where you're at today to hopefully make a more productive or have more impact in your industry going forward?
Yeah. So this will be a whole, I'm gonna try to condense this into a short piece, but I feel like this is like what I coach on. Right. But again, I'll just give it away. Like, essentially, if you're not content with where your bank account is, where your business looked like, there's only so many ways in the real estate world to increase those numbers, period, end of story. There's only so, like, there's not infinite, there's only a few. Number one, if you're not hitting the phones hard enough, half my guys, I'm like, hey, if you don't have the amount of deals that you want to have right now, it's only correlated to how much prospecting you're doing. So double the amount of prospecting you're doing, right? If you can double your leads, you'll double your business. Right? That's one. Two, work on your conversion of those leads. If you're great at prospecting and you're very active with your prospecting and you're not getting the amount of business you want, that probably means you have a conversion issue, which just really has to do with what does your follow-up systems look like? How often are you frequently touching base with them? What does the script look like? How many different modes of communication are you reaching out to them? Again, if you just doubled your conversion on the same amount of leads, you'll double your business. Third piece of it is your average sales price. If your average sales price is 200 grand, do you understand how long it will take you to be a millionaire? It would take you forever. If you just changed one piece of your business, if you doubled your sales price, you will double your business. So make sure you start prospecting on average, just slightly working on prospecting a little bit higher price points over time, and it will add up to a larger number. And the last piece of this is your commission percentage, right? We try to make sure that we really control our commission percentages on every deal, because if you change nothing about your business and you just doubled and worked on doubling your average commission percentage, you double your income. Now, again, if you took those four things and you doubled each one of them, you will massively change your income over a very short period of time, which is just things that I implement today, right? So just focus on those core four pillars. And I assure you, you will see in a 6, 12, 24 month period of time, you will make more money with ease, not stressfully, right? There might be a period of sacrifice, but with ease, you will see that you can increase your business.
That's amazing. Great advice, man. All right. So what we'll go ahead and do is we're going to open it up to Q&A. So if you guys are on the call, feel free to type away in the chat box. We want to make sure that we, you know, not necessarily just speak out because we have a good amount of people on the call. So I don't want to have a lot of people speak at one time. So if you could please go ahead and type away in the chat box. And I'm also on LinkedIn as well. So if you guys have some questions, feel free to type away. And then in the meantime, Henry, do you have a question or do you have a thing that maybe you wish I would have asked you that maybe I haven't yet that you could kind of share?
It's a good question, man. I like that question. Let's see here. I'm even curious just for your sake. I know that you've written a number of books, mm-hmm. about to write a book now. And I'm curious to get your thoughts. Do you feel like there's any sales book, business book that you've read recently that you feel like has been incredibly lucrative? I just bought Alex Hormozi's new book. I don't know if you bought that.
I haven't yet, but I'd love to buy it. I mean, his was it $100 million offers book was a great book. I mean, there's a lot of mindset shift, ideas in there that were great. I mean, really the main book that I read that kind of changed my perspective on everything was the Compound Effect by Darren Hardy. And I think the reason why was because it made it simple. So you obviously see these people who have accomplished great things in their life, and it's really hard to kind of understand how you can bridge the gap between where they're at and where you're at today. And so what I think that kind of gave me an idea of is that all it takes is just a few things every day. You don't really have to, you know, move mountains in a day. It's, you know, you make, like you said, 100 calls a day or 150 calls a day. Like, it's going to lead to something if you do it consistently. Now, if you only do it one day, you don't build that compounding effect. So it's just about the consistent act. All right. So Patricia, hey, how's it going? She says, how do you actually go about finding these deals, prospecting, relationships with real estate agents, something else?
Yeah. So again, we're a very heavy prospecting based team. I think that people get convoluted in the thinking of prospecting is lead generation. Like you don't have a business if you're not generating leads, right? So like, you know, kind of just boil it down. It's like, I don't care how you lead generate. My choice is cold calling. I love it. I enjoy it. I teach it. It's a part of my life. I enjoy it. I don't believe it's for everybody. You could do warm calls. You can do everything. But I personally use cold calling. We pull this from Reonomy and CoStar. That's how we find those deals. I also do everything else. So I also am networking with, you know, other real estate professionals. I'm walking, you know, working with contractors, accountants, commercial lenders, commercial attorneys, public adjusters, insurance brokers, everything you can possibly imagine, you know, on top of everything else.
It's awesome. Yeah. And obviously Henry, if you guys haven't a chance to check out his YouTube channel, you definitely should. I mean, obviously, you know, I know you and I have both been proponents of YouTube and other mediums like that to be able to generate opportunities as well. So
absolutely
it's part of the business generation process. I don't think it should be the only thing that you're doing, but I do think that can be extremely powerful, in particular over a longer period of time. So, all right. So Carrie, how's it going? They ask, can you talk more about the actual script your sales team uses in their initial contact calls with prospects?
Yeah. So our scripts are very simplistic, which, by the way, on my YouTube channel in the descriptions, you can download it for free, exactly what my script says. So you can download it for free, check it out. But essentially I'll just, you know, tell you the script is, hey, John, this is Henry with XYZ Real Estate calling you because we represent a client who's going through a 1031 exchange, and we were just curious if you'd be totally against selling your property. So that's on the broker side. And then we also use it on the investor side, which is saying basically the same thing other than I'm the investor. Say like, hey, I'm calling because my investment firm is, you know, we just sold off a few properties. We're going through a 1031 exchange and we need to spend some money before the end of the tax year. And we're curious if you'd be totally against selling your property. So we typically go back and forth between client or me being the investor specifically. Depends on the quality of lead, by the way. Like if I'm calling a much larger property, I know that they like to speak to principals versus if I'm calling a smaller property under like 50,000 square feet, under 10 million, you could probably get away with calling as a broker and you probably would get the same type of response. But typically on the larger deals, I found personally, because I always test and trial different scripts, that I found better being the investor.
Awesome. And the people you in these larger deals that you're looking at, most of these are institutional owners, correct?
Some type of institutional owner, right? I mean, like these are, you know, I'm definitely not calling 500 unit apartment complexes.
Yeah, sure.
You know, But I kind of joke around with people and I kind of say, like, listen, like the much larger stuff typically doesn't trade, right? Like, you know, they're often not looking to sell it, right? Unless they're incredibly motivated. So you're working through organizations who own a number of properties regardless. But yeah, I mean, most of the time, because I already have broker relationships, which is why I try to say I'm the principal.
Yeah.
You know, because I know then they'll give me more of a time of day.
Absolutely. So Patricia says, interesting that you're looking for a no answer on that. Where did you come up with that?
Alex reiterated, he's actually talked about this close for a long time. And it's funny because I come from the residential world. I did a lot of expired calls. I mean, this was 8 years ago, but I was a huge prospector for expired calls. And in that script, that's what it's like. The script I learned 8 years ago for expired calls would you be totally against listing the property? You know, would you be totally against still selling the property? Right. So I just continue taking that same script into what I'm doing now. And even Alex talks about like the saying the totally against it's a double negative essentially. So like, you know, you get them to think a little bit differently rather than were you open to selling your property? And they're like, no, like, are you totally against selling your property? No. Oh, yes. Wait, you know, like it gets them to think differently about it. And you typically get a better response.
Well, it's a pattern interrupt, you know, like you said, I mean, if you have a direct yes, no question, and there's no color to it, you know, it's very easy for someone just to say no. But if you're allowing them to kind of think about it, because again, that's more of a nuanced question. Are you totally against it? You know, they have to really think about it and say, well, am I really totally against it? And so, I mean, it's great, man. It's psychology. Like you're leveraging psychology to kind of elicit a response that, you know, potentially could get you an opportunity. So
listen, becoming a great prospector, right? Prospecting on the phones, being a great salesperson in general takes mastering the art of communication, which is just languaging, right? And, you know, while being kind and straightforward and honest, you know, and if you can do all those things and have very strategic languaging, like you're saying certain things, like I'm not just saying things to say things, right? Have you ever been in a conversation, you just say things on the phone because you don't know what specifically to say? I'm saying things specifically to get a result. Right. So that's all that sales is. It's just asking the right questions in order to get a result. That's what sales is. Right. I mean, again, because it's just asking strategic questions. So, but asking those using the correct languaging and verbiage is going to get you a much different result than an average salesperson.
Absolutely. No, couldn't agree more. And listening, I mean, like you said, some people just speak to speak. And I feel like a lot of times, in particular, when I first started in the business, I have no sales experience whatsoever. And so I was literally going down a list and just calling and just throwing things at the wall, see what sticks. And even when I got a response that was not normal, like, you know, most of the time it's like, no, we're not interested, blah, bye, whatever. But then as soon as there was something that said, oh, well, you know, we may be interested, at that point, you're like, you know, like you're kind of stuck in this limbo state where you're like, I don't really know how to respond. But through practice and iteration, you kind of get more comfortable in those types of environments. And not only that, but listening to what they actually are saying, like, you know, because you get so much insight from just having a conversation with someone and really listening for those pain points. So,
yeah, it's like I found that it's interesting how most people already are thinking about what they're looking to say next instead of listening so that you can listen to respond appropriately. Right. Because what's fascinating is sales is like I reiterated before, is asking great questions. And those great questions come from listening to what their responses are. And the person who's asking the questions is in control, right? So if you are the one, if we're having a conversation and I'm the seller and I'm asking you questions, how did you get my phone number? You know, why would, you know, like, what's your offer? Like I'm controlling the conversation. So you need to learn to handle these objections, which aren't just like, think about it. They're just asking you a question, but we're overthinking about how, like, oh my God, I don't know what to say. They're just asking you a question. How'd you get my phone number? I got it from the online tax records. So John, the reason for the phone call was because, again, we're going through a 1031 exchange. You go back into, you control the, like you answer and then flip to a question. You answer and then flip to a question. You can't just say a statement because then all of a sudden you're both just staring at each other blankly. Like, okay, what's next?
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to realize too, I mean, we are calling someone out of the blue. I mean, to them, they're just going about their day and all of a sudden they're getting a call. And, you know, so even understanding that, you know, a lot of people are somewhat on edge, like understanding that, modifying your body language and voice control too, like just being very calm and collected on the call makes a huge difference in how people respond to you.
I'm laughing at you because, you know, I back in my earlier years of prospecting, I always learned, I heard the word matching and mirroring, right? Mm-hmm. Very early in my career, which is matching their tonality and rate of speech and mirroring the best you can. And they would even tell me, and again, this was almost a decade ago, where they were like, you know, not that you want to match their accent exactly, but you want to change how you speak. Because again, I'm from New Jersey, right? New York, New Jersey, we talk really fast. We are very fast paced. If I call somebody, you know, let's just say if I'm calling an older woman who owns a property for 20 years and I'm speaking really, really quickly, years ago, I would get someone, she would always be like, can you slow down? I can't understand what you're saying. And then I realized that matching and mirroring is like, I need to speak her language and speak slowly and softly and, you know, like very gentle with my voice. But if I'm speaking to a high D personality, why'd you call me? What, who is this? What, like, if they're like that, I need to match their level on the phone, because if you're coming off gentle and like soft to that person, it's not going to work. And it's like just being matching them wherever they are, wherever they are. And it's just sometimes funny because my sales guys were just making fun of me this morning, because like I do it like I match a mirror so well sometimes. They're like, oh, I'm guessing you were speaking to so and so. Yes, I was. And they kind of pick it up based on how I change my tonality.
That's awesome, man. So Sam has a question. You say, what is the ideal outcome you're looking for in that first call or interaction?
Great question. Great question. So a couple key things to keep in mind. Number one, motivation, right? Number one is how motivated, what's that scale look like? How motivated is this person to actually sell the property? Two is that I want as much information as possible to not only gauge that level of motivation, but vet the deal. I want to be able to underwrite the deal next. Because think about it, the next step in these deals is to make an offer. That is my next step. I'm not looking to set an appointment, which you could easily, by the way, at the very beginning of your career, you can practice by doing that. And all you do is simply in the middle of the conversation, be like, John, I appreciate this conversation. Simply our next step here is to just simply set an appointment. What works better for you, afternoons or evenings? And you just go right into closing for an appointment. You can easily do that. Go tour the property. You know, go get your feet wet if you're a brand new agent. If you're looking to really enhance your production, I don't go on appointments. I don't need to see a property in person to underwrite a deal and make an offer. So I want as much information as possible so I can make an appropriate offer, right? So it's gauging motivation. Why would you even consider, you know, if they say, oh yeah, we're open to selling the property. Great. Did you happen to have a number in mind? Gauge their mindset in regards to their pricing. Ask them a few questions. Do you occupy the property, or is this strictly an investment property for you? When you do sell the property, what do you plan on doing with the money? Or do you live in the same state? You know, are you actively managing this yourself, or do you happen to have a property management company? I want to know how involved in the deal are they, right? What's actually going to change if they sell this property, right? And then I can flip into like, if in order to get you the best price possible, I would, you know, I'd love to review some financials, or would you like me just to throw a random all cash offer at you right now? Right. So like, and it's really, and like trying to like make it like, no, I don't want you to do that. I want you to, you know, give me, in order to get you the best price possible. Right. Like, you know, so, you know, this way I can try to vet the deal, but it's mostly about the money and the motivation, you know, try to underwrite and understand the process here.
That's awesome. Great insight. All right.
Great questions, by the way.
It's always, great discussion. So I really appreciate you guys engaging and looking forward to hearing you guys' questions. So if you guys have any questions on Zoom, feel free to type away. We have some people listening on LinkedIn as well. So if you guys are interested in asking a question, feel free to ask away.
What other lucrative, I mean, even just for yourself, you know, because I can continue chatting about this, but I'd love to, you know, just to kind of, you know, go back and forth with you. Mm-hmm. What other lucrative strategies have you found in this market, whether it's for finding deals or for structuring deals?
Yeah. So, you know, I know we talked a little bit about it on your podcast. So I've been working a lot with bigger property owners and developers that are looking for land. And so what we've been doing is we've been trying to identify properties that are in the path of progress that have a potential to be rezoned. And then we work with the owner and get them on board, even if their pricing's a little bit off of what we would expect a property of that similar status to be zoned. If they're open to giving us whatever it takes to rezone the property, that's kind of where we've been taking our approach, and it's worked very well thus far. We've done it on several occasions recently. I think property owners right now are still kind of in flux as far as what they expect their property worth, even though we're in this kind of flux environment. And so if you could say, hey, we'll get you your price, but we need a year to rezone.
100%.
Yeah. And we make a contingent upon a rezone. So if for some reason we can't get the rezoning, then we obviously back out. Granted, that takes a longer duration. So maybe the closing timeline is a year from now. But again, it can make you structure a deal such that it becomes very attractive. And a lot of these deals that we're targeting are obviously, you know, compared to New York, New Jersey, maybe not huge deals, but several million dollars as far as land acquisition. So,
yeah, I agree. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, super smart. I mean, I think that it's realizing, like, again, similar to what you're understanding or what you just explained here, is that throughout this type of market shift with, you know, interest rates and everything else, deals are just becoming more creative. Right. And the more creative we can think, the higher the ability we have to convert. And there's still, I mean, like, it was just interesting, right? So in the state of New Jersey, we were just looking, I think there was, you know, between a couple, I think it was like multifamily, retail and industrial in the state of Jersey, there was like 3,300 transactions in the last 12 months. And I'm talking to my team and I'm like, do you understand how much opportunity there is? Like, there was like everyone who's saying that there's no, absolutely no activity and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, there was 3,300 transactions within the last 12 months. It's like, how many of those do you need before you make a decent amount of money? Right. Like, it's like, you know, there's an unlimited amount of opportunity regardless of what the market looks like. And it's just starting to think, even like you were mentioning before, like, instead of just buying a traditional property, why don't I find properties that are in great zoning? And then, you know, or that have the ability to shift zoning a little bit, right? Because they have flexible zoning ability, right? And then turn it into something that could be super valuable, because it isn't valuable right now. But how do I turn it into something that has some value and make the spread in between? It's like, great idea. Cool. It's like, and then you can find those opportunities. You can do, like, there's just, you can't think like everything's been the same for 20 years, because things are changing and forever will be.
Yeah, no, 100%. And like you said, even though the transactions have dropped off, you don't need a significant number of transactions, in particular if your target range, like you had mentioned, if you target the right deals, if you improve on these different variables in, within your business, you don't need an unlimited amount of deals to make a pretty solid income in this business. But you do need to be very cognizant and deliberate about how you approach the process, because to be quite honest, a lot of people are going to wash out over the next couple of years. It's just a reality. And that just means that if you have the staying power and you approach your business in the proper way, you can really come out of this thing and like a rocket ship. So
absolutely. And listen, like, even like I was joking with a few friends of mine, I'm like, listen, even if hypothetically from 2022 to 2026, the next couple of years, because like, who knows how long this interest rate's gonna last, but you just think a little bit longer term, a few years, if you just made the same amount of money every single year, right, at a worst case scenario, right, because everyone probably knocked it out of the park in 2020, 2021, it's like, if you only made the same or maybe a smidge less and you just adjusted things for two or three short years, when things come back, you'll double your income in a year.
Easily. I mean, yeah. And you put in the groundwork right now. I mean, that's another thing. Like, obviously we're big proponents of it, but even focusing on your presence and your branding and getting out there and putting your face out there and getting, like, inundating your market with an understanding of who you are as a broker. Cause I know, I know there's some people on the call that, you know, call on property all across the country, but, you know, even if you're a broker like myself, who's kind of region specific, like inundating people with, who's this person? Oh, they do commercial real estate. And you do that from all different avenues, all different facets. So when the time comes for transactions to be done, you're one of the top three people they think of, maybe the number one, because it's like, most people don't know people that are brokers. I mean, obviously the residential side maybe, but in commercial real estate, there's not a whole lot of us compared to residential agents. So, absolutely. I mean, it's very easy to stand out.
100%.
So Patricia asked another question. She said, any suggestions for a newbie interested in medical real estate?
A couple of things to keep in mind is, one, the type of asset class that you're targeting needs to be more of a reason beyond your personal interest. Is that market moving right now? Like, I just spoke to an agent based out of Seattle, who they're at an office only brokerage and they specialize in office leasing. And I'm like, just because you like it and you have been doing it doesn't mean it's lucrative today, right? So I'm not trying to allude to that medical office isn't doing halfway decent right now. You know, for sure in certain areas it's doing good. But also just keep in mind that, like, I would just say, hey, no attachment, no nothing. What is the hottest asset class right now in the area that I'm in or that I can prospect? It's industrial. It's multifamily. It's medical. I don't know what it is in your area, right? It's like, why don't you just prospect that and also work with, because if that's trading, like again, of the 3,300 transactions, if 60% of it was one asset class, I probably should call that asset class other than the one that's at 1% right now. That wouldn't make any sense, right? So, but it's like, just be strategic about that for a moment. And then the other piece of it is, what does your network provide you, right? If your network right now is a bunch of people who are looking for industrial properties, you probably should not prospect any other asset class. That would be really silly if that's what your network is. And again, I know this is pretty bare bones stuff, but often we just prospect the prospect, right? Like, but you prospect what you sell. And if you're not prospecting what you can sell, it doesn't make any sense.
100%. That's some great advice. And, you know, actually a question for you, Patricia, is there a reason you're focusing on medical real estate? And I love medical real estate. I think it's obviously can be quite lucrative. It's just kind of curious as to why that. I mean, no, I know talking offline with Henry before, you know, I'm focused on retail. And the reason I'm focused on retail is because the brokers that I joined happen to do a lot of retail. So I just naturally fell into it. And, you know, luckily over the last, let's say, 12 to 24 months, retail has been actually performing extremely well, in particular in the leasing side and even some investing side on the shopping center. And so, so Patricia says, I come from a nurse family. I'm not a nurse. Medical is interesting. That's great.
Yeah. And like, listen, like, I'm a huge fan of saying like, listen, I'm not saying you can't be passionate about something. That's awesome and wonderful. And Grant Cardone is really brash about it, but you know, it's pretty damn accurate. It's like, sometimes your passions aren't profitable, right? And that's okay. It doesn't mean like you can't do things in that industry to be supportive. And it just means if you want to be incredibly successful in this industry, it just might not be the right time to be targeting that specifically. Right. And by the way, there's a lot of nursing home transactions. There's a ton of them. Right. But if you don't know the nursing home buyers, you probably won't make money in that industry. Right. It can be very, unless you, but you know, the last piece I'll say on this is my niche is not an asset class. It's a way of looking at a deal. I'm an investment broker. I look for fantastic investment deals in any asset class, land, industrial, everything, right? So I just look to see if I can make money on this deal, right? That's what I look for. So if you can find a great price nursing home, a great price, any type of property, you're going to make money.
Definitely. Oh, couldn't agree more. So, well, we're running up close on the hours, so I just want to be respectful of everyone's time. First off, Henry, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure we've gained a lot of value from this. I know I have. I know this discussion is going to lead to a lot of questions. If you guys are watching this on YouTube and LinkedIn as well, you know, we'll be able to, you know, get your thoughts on it as well. If people want to learn more about you, wanted to get more contact, I know you offer coaching as well. So if people want to learn more about that, how could they get in contact with you?
Yeah. So just Google my name. I'm literally on every single platform. You know, Henry Eisenstein, you know, for a lot of individuals, you can find on my YouTube and check out my YouTube channel. It has all the links in the description below where you can literally get every bit of resources. I have a ton of free courses, by the way. There's nothing really to sell. Ton of free courses, free content, free scripts, free everything. Take advantage of it. You know, look forward to connect with you, everyone.
Absolutely. And we'll include all that in the show notes. So if you guys are watching this on YouTube, go ahead and down there, we'll include his LinkedIn page, his YouTube page, everything else. So you guys can gain access to that. If you guys are watching or listening to this in a podcast format, I'll leave the description as well. So
awesome.
Again, thank you so much, Henry. Thank you everyone who stopped by today. It was a really great discussion. Continue to come back, continue to engage. We do this every other week where we host a variety of different speakers to talk about commercial real estate. And we thank you all so much for the support. So we'll see you guys later.
Thank you.